Blog Talk Radio. Radio. I'm Rich Ferguson, L.A. poet, musician, performer, author of the poetry collection Eighth in Agony, out on Punk Hostage Press, and you are listening to Poet Escape. Welcome, everyone. Today, I'm very pleased to have as my guest the singer, songwriter, and so much more, Suzzy Roach. How are you, Suzzy?
I'm good.
Yeah, thank you for being on the show.
It's great to be on your show, and congratulations for having a show.
Well, thank you, and congratulations for being you, man. I love your work, and I'm so excited to, you know, ask you all these questions. You know, as previously mentioned, Suzzy Roach is a singer-songwriter and also a founding member of the singing group The Roaches. Suzzy has recorded over 15 albums, written music for TV and film, and has toured extensively for 30 years across the U.S. and Europe. Suzzy has been an associate member of the Wooster Group, the experimental theater company based in New York City, and has performed with them off and on for years. She's also an accomplished writer. Her children's book, Want to Be in a Band, released by Random House, was published in January of this year. And her first novel, Wayward Saints, released by Hyperion Voice, was selected by Barnes & Noble as one of their Discover Great New Writers program. Suzzy, why don't we start out by having you talk about your musical beginnings, how you and your sisters came together to form The Roaches, and how you got your big break.
Well, we actually started, I guess it's got to be 40 years ago, is that possible? We started singing on the streets of New York City, on the sidewalks, actually. And our big break was that there was a guy who owned a club called Folk City in the village, in Greenwich Village, that is, and he asked us if we wanted to do a gig, and he advertised it as Girls, Girls, Girls. And that was our big break.
Nice. Nice. Now, were you guys also backup singers for Paul Simon at one point?
Oh, you know, my two sisters, Maggie and Terry, they sang on Paul's record, There Goes Ryman Simon. They sang on a song called Was a Sunny Day.
Nice. Nice. You know, that first record, The Roaches, which was released in 1979, and it was this folk mashup of like barbershop, doo-wop, Celtic, bluegrass, you know, and even more interesting, I noticed that it was produced by Robert Fripp, someone that I often associate with bands like King Crimson, Bowie, and Brian Eno. How was it that you ended up pairing up with Fripp, and what was he able to bring out in your music?
Well, you know, he came down to see us in New York, and it was kind of an unlikely pairing, I suppose you could say. But at the time, he was just being hired by Warner Brothers as a producer, like an in-house producer, and they were also interested in us, in signing us. So it made sense, and we hit it off immediately. He's quite a character, and he wanted to record us as we were. He used the phrase audio verite, and so we were interested in that. We didn't want to do a whole production thing recording-wise, so it was like a perfect kind of fit that seemed like a surprise to everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty stripped-down record. Were as you went on as The Roaches, would you say that there were other records where you got a bit more into production, or have you always kind of kept the sound pared down?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we were on a major label when we first got signed, and everybody, you know, was surprised in the major label world that we were even signed because we were so unusual. But we had a real big fan base, and the record was pretty successful. And so the what immediately happens next, of course, is that the record companies say, well, you know, you got to get a hit single, and let's put you with this producer and that producer, and you know, so then you start down on the road of making records that, you know, are, you know, you have to compromise, I guess, and they're paying for them,
right.
So you know, that was part of it. Of course, that era is over with now, and people can now make their own records. So, in
sure.
a way, it's gotten much better.
Yeah, you know, speaking of a certain era being over with, I'm going to sort of cast this in a different light as opposed to an era now where people can record their own records and the like. But, you know, I was thinking about something in preparation for this show and in preparation for speaking with you. You know, you've spent your life in New York City most of the time in or around the Village, I believe. You know, during the 60s and thereabouts, it was a real hotbed for folk music, music geared toward politics and socialism. What are your current thoughts on the current state of music? Do you think folk music or music of politics and activism is still as popular and embraced as it used to be, or has that died down?
Well, it certainly is not what it used to be, and I'm not sure that that's a bad thing. I mean, I'm all for, you know, the whatever is happening now. I don't really like to look back too much, but it's true that a lot of the music from that era had to do with what was going on in the world. You know, protest songs, we used to call them, I guess. But and now, I don't know if it's because the world is so much more confusing and you can't. I was just talking to a young person the other day, and we were talking about how you can't believe anything that anybody says, you know, and I think that that's something that's happened in this generation where there's a kind of, there is no right or wrong or side to be on because nobody really believes anything, because there are no, quote, reliable sources, you know. So I don't really know what the answer to that is. But it certainly is different, that's for sure.
With that sort of climate, you know, what position does that put you in as an artist in regards to how you shape what you do or what you say?
Well, at this stage of the game for me, I'm sort of always on the lookout for something that seems authentic, you know, and that's true in my own work. You know, I'm always trying to find something that rings true to me, but also with other people's work, and it can be very varied. You know, I like a lot of different kinds of things. But I mean, actually, as you know, your work seems to be incredibly, you know, focused on what's going on in the world today in a very different way than, say, Bob Dylan was.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, even in the context of Facebook, it's like, you know, the things that you post on Facebook seem to be very much putting something out into the world, you know, that's useful to people. And that's really great, I think.
Well, thank you for saying that, and I'm honored. So, thank you.
Yeah, but it's really true, and I think it's a really important distinction about, you know, if you're asking me what I'm interested in, I'm always looking for where that's actually happening.
Yeah.
You know, and I definitely think you're doing that.
Well, thank you. You know, in regards to the Roaches, has it ever been a challenge for you and your sisters to balance out egos, or shall I say, figure out a way for the three of you to share equal spotlight?
Well, you know, the very unique and unusual thing about the Roaches was that we were not really three separate entities. It was one thing, you know,
right.
Even in terms of that there was not really often a melody in the end. Everything had three parts, and you know, so, and in our live performances, to me anyway, it always seemed like we were three things that made up a whole. And
yeah.
I love that kind of thing, because I like to be a part of a collaboration with other people. And
yeah.
I like to sing with people, and I like the idea of having different people's songs to work on and stuff like that. So for me, it was not a difficult thing. I kind of thrive on that. I don't know what my sisters would say to that. Of course, we are siblings, and, you know, a lifetime of spending enormous amounts of time together and rehearsing
sure.
and traveling, and, you know, it has worn down, you know, our desire to do that all the time after so many years. But but we certainly had many, many great years of fun and creative freedom. I mean, we were
yeah.
very lucky. We got to do whatever we wanted, really.
Yeah. You know, that was, you touched on something that actually I noticed when listening to the Roaches, and for that matter, when listening to you and your daughter Lucy sing together. There's, I mean, your voices blend so well together that it does literally sound like one voice, or at least a situation where you can hardly distinguish between one voice and another. And so, yeah, I obviously it comes from a lot of practice, a lot of spending, you know, time together. Would you say that comes from something else as well, how you're able to do that so fluidly?
I guess one of the things is a technical thing, which is that when I've been working on records, I like to mix the vocals equally
nice.
Instead of having a lead singer and a background vocal. And so, you know, that really creates a different effect. And it does, it's more of a choral effect. And it just takes, I don't know, it makes it into a third thing instead of just, you know, two people singing. I don't know how to describe it, but it does have a different effect when you hear a solo voice and a background voice than when you hear harmonies equally mixed.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you and the Roaches, I mean, you performed at Carnegie Hall. I was looking at your bio, I was looking at all your accomplishments, and I was like, my first thought was like, man, I can't believe Suzy wants to be on my show. But my next thought was, I mean, because you've done some amazing things over the course of your career. I mean, you've performed at Carnegie, you've performed with Philip Glass. I mean, you've so many great things, but I was stuck on the Carnegie Hall thing and just thinking, you know, when you were first starting out with music or first starting, you know, singing with your sisters, I mean, you must have had dreams of like, oh, one day, wouldn't it be great to play Carnegie Hall? And then it actually happens for you. What was that like?
Well, you know, I was so young when we started to sing, and we immediately became, you know, pretty successful way before I even knew what I was doing. Honestly, it was all very exciting and fast moving and things like that. But I had some sort of sense at a very early age that, oh, this is not about Carnegie Hall or where you're, you know, this is about a lifetime of doing this, and it's going to go all over the place. It's going to take you through your life, and
right.
that's exactly what's happened. I mean, playing at Carnegie Hall was great, and it was exciting and everything, and all the shows. I mean, the way we met was amazing.
Yes, exactly.
The show we did, what's the name of the town that we did it in?
I can't, you know, I was trying to remember the name of the town, but it was like some small town in Wisconsin. But I mean, think of the odds of something like that even happening. Yeah.
I know. Well, it was so, I don't know how to describe it to the people who might be listening, but it was really in the middle of nowhere. And
yeah.
it was, you know, there were not even that many people there. And it was a fundraiser for our friend John.
For John Kenworthy, yeah, for Brick
yes.
by Brick.
And he does a great, you know, he raises money to build schools in Africa for his organization, Brick by Brick.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
we happened to, you and I were, and David
right.
David Mansfield did a concert
yeah.
for benefit. And you know, not really a lot of people came, except for one person donated a lot of money. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, but, it was amazing. I mean, I was just, you know, I didn't know what to expect when I was, you know, taking a plane to Wisconsin and, like, you know, stepping into this town with a water tower. And, you know, just it was really quaint. But then it's just like I hook up with you and David Mansfield, an amazing guitarist. You know, his credentials are rock solid as well. And it was just like, wow. And then, you know,
I
was honored.
And, you know, honestly, that night I will never forget. And as far as, you know, all the, you know, that's what I'm trying to say, is that the Carnegie Halls of your life are just as amazing as those nights. And
right.
that's the thing about this life that I feel like I've been blessed to live. You know, I've had so many experiences like that where you just never know, you know. And some of them, of course, are horrible, too. And they can be the ones that everyone thinks are the, you know, the greatest. But that was quite a night. And we have remained
yes.
friends for, you know,
we
ever
have.
Since that, you know.
We have. And you also were, you know, I'm forever indebted for you getting me involved with that benefit, you know, the 10th anniversary of 9/11, where, you know, you
oh,
were
right.
helping to raise money for firefighters who had gotten sick with cancer or other ailments, you know, after 9/11. And man, what a night that was. I mean, you know, you, Marshall Crenshaw, so many amazing people on that bill.
I know. You got to come back to New York.
I want to come back to New York. Yeah. Yeah, I love it there. You know, well, you know, speaking of New York real quick, in Greenwich Village, I mean, I think you, if I'm not mistaken, you pretty much spent most of your life there, right?
That's actually true. I haven't actually stopped to think about it, but I have spent most of my life here. And you know
yeah.
what? When I was a little girl growing up in the suburbs of New York, in New Jersey, I used to dream of living in Greenwich Village. And that is something that actually came true.
Nice. How has it changed or remained the same over the years?
Oh, God, it has changed drastically. It's and I wouldn't say for the better either. Of course, like every place else, I mean, they've taken all this, the small businesses away, and now it's all, you know, very expensive clothes stores and things that nobody in the neighborhood wants, and, you know, big nightclubs and brunches spilling out onto the streets. And but there are moments that are still beautiful here. It's different in the village because the streets are all crooked. They don't go in the normal grate that the rest of the city is in. So the
yeah.
light is incredibly beautiful here. And it's also gotten very expensive for people to live here. I have a, you know, rent stabilized apartment, so I'm kind of
nice.
Burrowed in. But
nice.
I love it here. It would take a lot to get me out of here. But if I lost my apartment, I wouldn't be able to afford to live here for sure.
Yeah, funny how that works. You know, with Loudon Wainwright III, you had a daughter, Lucy Wainwright Roach. And, you know, you've been performing with her a lot, recording with her. First off, what's it like to create and perform with your daughter?
It's actually amazingly, you know, we're very compatible. We know each other, obviously, for our whole life. And we have grown up together, literally.
Mm-hmm.
It's been nothing but a joy, I have to say. The music is different from anything I've ever really done before. It's very simple and very pure, and we have a lot of fun together traveling It's just been a very pleasant surprise. I never thought that anything like that would happen. And we just started recording together because we were trying to figure out a way to raise some money for her recording, which is just to come out on October 16th.
And what's that going to be called?
It's called There's a Last Time for Everything. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful recording that she made, but she didn't want to use, she didn't want to do a Kickstarter thing, you know. So
right.
we came up with the idea of doing a couple of other tunes and offering them as a bonus to pre-order the record. But then when we started working on the record, we just continued and made an entire record. And so that's why we had Fairy Tale and Myth, which is what I sent you some tracks from.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, well, why don't we go ahead and talk about that for a moment. So you've got Fairy Tale and Myth that you created with Lucy, and I believe Fairy Tale and Myth is named after a Rob Morseberger song, is that right?
That's right. Rob Morseberger is the person that Lucy and I worked with on this record, and Rob, we recorded one of his songs called Everyone Wants to Be Loved, and...
Right.
In that song is the lyric Fairy Tale and Myth. And
yeah.
Rob was an incredible musician. He was diagnosed with brain cancer about a year and a half ago, and just we lost him a couple of months ago. But during the time that he was sick, he wanted to do music, you know, ferociously. And so we recorded this record after his second brain surgery, and when he was, you know, nearly blind, and we sat in his freezing cold studio in our winter coats, and it was just, you know, it was very sad because we loved him, and we don't have him around anymore, but the experience of making the record was just totally joyful, and just such a surprise, you know, and a gift that he gave to Lucy and I to record that record with us. It's just really very moving.
Nice. Well, why don't we play a track from the record? First of all, before we play the track, because I know the collection are songs that you've written, but also songs by other folks. This first song, Broken Stem Tenderness, is this one of your songs or by another artist?
It is, actually, and I wish that I had, I thought that you wanted only my songs, but I could have sent you Rob's song, which is so
beautiful. No. I love your song, so I'm glad that you said, not that I, you know, wouldn't want anyone else's, but I just wanted to make that distinction before we played it.
Yes.
This
one.
Good. All right, so why don't we go ahead and play it from Fairy Tale and Myth by Lucy Wainwright Roach and Suzy Roach, Broken Stem Tenderness.
It's a genuine spot, like it or not, out in the middle of can roll
What a beautiful song. That was Broken Stem Tenderness by Lucy Wainwright Roach and Suzzy Roach. Suzzy, so many beautiful lines in that song. 'Twas a blessing and curse there to be nursed out in the middle of nowhere, and broken stem tenderness waiting in the wilderness. What was the inspiration for that song?
I go to Big Sur every year. And there's a walk that I take down to Pfeiffer Beach. There's a two-mile road that goes down to Pfeiffer Beach. And the woods on either side of the road are amazing. They just have all of this wild growth in them. And I love to look at the little tiny flowers that are underneath all the other flowers. You know, and I've just been doing this for years, and I go there and I get down on the ground and I look underneath, you know, bushes and stuff to find these little flowers. And I just find that, you know, for some reason it's been like this weird little thing that I've been obsessed with. And so I think it's taught me a lot, you know.
Yeah.
Looking, just walking that walk so many years. And so I was thinking about actually Rob Morseberger, and as we were working on this record, and just there was something about the flower being broken, you know, and just the tenderness of it all, of
sure.
the situation we were working in. And that song just kind of came out.
Yeah. You know, you have strong family ties to the Roach clan, the Wainwright clan, and, you know, that sense of belonging, togetherness really comes out through your music, be it live or recorded. And, you know, and you mentioned this earlier, you know, I also know that you've gone into uncharted territory from time to time, leaving your comfort zone to collaborate with different artists. How have those experiences helped further shape you as an artist, and can you share one or two of those experiences with us?
Oh, well, I am definitely somebody who travels into places where I don't feel comfortable to work with people. I love being a guest in somebody else's work. And, for example, I've had a long relationship with the Worcester Group here in New York.
Yeah.
Our experimental theater company, and they are a very close-knit group of people who have been working together for years, and I kind of come in and out of the group from time to time, but I've gotten so much out of working with them, and I just feel totally indebted to them and other artists that I've worked with for just what it does, how it enriches my own work, you know, to travel into places where I wouldn't necessarily have thought I belonged, you know.
Right. You know, I've got to ask this question because it's something I've wondered for some time. Is it something in the DNA or the drinking water or perhaps tons of good karma you've collected throughout many lifetimes? I mean, what is it exactly that makes the Roach, Wainwright, McGarrickle clans so talented? I mean, do all of you ever get together and just look at one another and say, damn, we are good?
Well, I wouldn't exactly say that happens, but
right.
No, it is kind of an interesting phenomenon that has occurred.
Yeah.
I don't really know why it's been like that, but it's very true that all of the people in those, both of those families, are musicians and, you know, very talented, and everybody has a different kind of expression too, which is another thing. It's not like we all sound the same, or so it's been interesting. I'm sure it must. It's almost embarrassing, I guess, but it does. It looks, it must look strange from the outside.
Well, it definitely looks unique, and it's definitely left me scratching my head, wondering how the heck do they do it. But yeah, I'm sure it looks a little different on the inside. But you know, well done, man.
Well, one of the things it does for you is you at least you understand each other's work. You know, you understand that it's the nature of the work. I guess it's like a family who ran a dry cleaners together. You know, like that you would kind of know what each other did, and that helps.
Well, if you guys ever start a dry cleaner, I will fly across the country to bring my clothes to you. Why don't we go ahead and play another song from Fairy Tale and Myth? Does that sound cool with you?
Sure.
Good. This one is called Imaginary Friend. That was Imaginary Friend from Fairy Tale and Myth by Suzzy Roach and Lucy Wainwright Roach. Suzzy, what is your songwriting process with Lucy?
Well, actually, we haven't written a song together yet. We may do that, but we haven't done it together yet. On this record, I wrote all the songs that I wrote, and then we did some covers of other people. But and the reason that was because her record is coming out, and all of her songs are on that record. So
got it.
But that song came about because I was waiting for somebody to come over to rehearse with me. And the person didn't show up, and I felt so bad. It was being stood up on a date or something. I was just heartbroken. And I sat down and wrote that song.
Well, good for you. Good for you for getting something out of the experience. So, you know, besides an accomplished musician, singer, songwriter, you know, you're also a writer, and you have a novel, a very kick-ass novel, Wayward Saints. Perhaps you can tell the listeners what it's about and what inspired it.
Well, I would say what inspired it, I'm sort of interested in, you know, what happens to people after the public eye turns away from them. You know, like you see all these rocker people, and they have to do outrageous things, and then, you know, a couple of years later, nobody ever hears about them anymore. And
right.
So I'm sort of was interested in the idea of what happens to somebody who kind of crashes and burns. And so the novel is about a young girl who runs away from home, and she's troubled but very talented in a raw kind of way, and she, you know, joins a band, and they kind of make it big for a couple of years, and then the whole thing kind of burns out, and then she's winds up in her 30s and she's nowhere. And so her mother, who she hasn't seen for 20 years or so, calls her one day and asks her, it says that the high school teacher at the local high school wants her to come back and do a solo concert at the high school. And so the whole book is about leading up to that concert. And through it, the mother and daughter go through their own sort of examination of what happened to their family and, you know, to their lives. And
right.
So that's really what the book is about.
Mm-hmm. I believe you have a section that you're going to read for us now, something actually from the beginning of the book?
Yeah, this is a sort of abridged beginning of the book, just something that wasn't too long to read for the radio.
Great.
So
great.
I hope it's not too long. I'll rush through.
It'll be a pleasure.
All right, here goes. It was a Tuesday night at Crud, a club on the outskirts of Glasgow, and the place was packed with skinheads and their girlfriends. Donald Hogan, the band's manager, had warned them that the room was a bit dungeonesque, but worse than that, it was a rat hole, and it smelled like a gas station latrine. Mary Saint stood behind the curtain by the side of the stage, peeking out into the audience, and cursed him. Sliced Ham had been all over England, blowing rooms away, mostly playing for college kids and hipsters, but Mary knew these weren't her people. They would eat the band alive. She noticed one guy in particular, his arms sticking out like legs of lamb, stained with tattoos. He stood in a line of other freaks, his elbows leaning on the edge of the stage, but he didn't seem to be hanging out with any of them. He scowled at the microphone where Mary was going to be standing, and every couple of minutes he'd say something to it. Oh, great, she thought. She rubbed her lips against the red velvet curtain as if it were a baby blanket. The thing was filthy and burned with cigarette holes. If only she hadn't left the bottle of tequila in the dressing room. It was too close to showtime to run down to the basement and take another swig. She checked her bra to see if her guitar picks were in place and pulled up her stockings, bunched her hair with her fingers, making sure not to disturb the blue feather she had pinned into a curl. It was a gift from the new bass player, what the hell she'd wear it for the show. The floor, which was sticky from the monitor man's beef stew that he'd eaten half of cold out of the can, it had been knocked over in the sound check and left there. She kicked at it with her high-heeled shoes. Where the hell was the band? One by one, they came up from the dressing room, heads drooping, shifting from foot to foot. The drummer flicked his cigarette down to the floor as they waited in a line in the tiny backstage area. The wall by the stage was signed by some of the bands that had played there. The Four Broke Blokes, the Don't Ask Me's, Jed Syringe, and the Shoot-Ups. The Shoot-Ups had left an illustration, somebody's idea of a masterpiece, some kind of phallic guitar. There were assorted rear ends, breasts, scribbles and flowers, swastikas, hearts, and messages like Big Barf Bag, Love Sheena, and Boink Me Bitch. Mary leaned her head against the wall, covered her face with her arm, and tried to breathe until the lights went down and the crowd raised its collective voice into a scream. She looked behind her to see if the band was ready. "Go," she said, as if she were the only soldier leading unsuspecting farmers into a battle she knew they couldn't win. They stomped onto the stage and picked up their instruments. Mary's shiny red guitar threw light across the audience, which stood shoulder to shoulder in the packed cellar. She strummed down hard and wailed, her voice sharp and spiked with agony. Like a hatchet, it cut their brains in two. To her surprise, the room went dumb. She wasn't pretty, just beautiful, and she had no idea. She thought she was plain. Her hair, a nest of black loose curls, flew around her wide face. Her skin was pale and smooth, and her cheeks had a natural tint. She could have been a breakable China doll, except for her dark raccoon eyes, which marked her expression with perpetual melancholy, giving her the look of an abandoned child. The spotlights and specials created a halo around her head in the smoky haze. She looked toward heaven crazily like a bird whose wing was hooked into a gate. Standing tall on her skinny legs, her hips swaying underneath satin boxer shorts, she let her hands explore her body. They caressed her arms and face and breasts, and they danced in the sacred space around her, like everyone in the room wished they could do. The skinheads and their girlfriends weren't that hard to pull in after all. The magic of Mary Saint had exploded all over them, and she was their new best friend. So that's it.
That was beautiful. That was Suzzy Roach reading from her novel, Wayward Saints. Suzzy, you know, one of my favorite writers, Lori Moore, wrote a review of your novel for the New York Times. That must have felt nice, huh?
That was so amazing. I am such a huge fan of hers, and I had no idea she was going to do that, and it was just a great, a real blessing for me. You know, I was just so thrilled, and I couldn't believe it, you know, that she would write, that she would even read it, much less write it. But that was one of the thrills of doing this, because I never really had thought I would write a novel. It just sort of happened, and that was another one of the shocks of my life.
Right. Well, actually, what got you into the novel? I mean, what sort of was the kickstart?
Well, I had met the novelist Meg Wolitzer, who's a friend of mine, and she started introducing me around to all her friends who are all novelists, and I was, you know, going to readings and stuff like that, and I met an editor, and she read some of my stories, and I had written a 5-page short story, and it was kind of based on this character, and she told me, she said, you should take that and write a novel. And so I was kind of at large with not a lot of work to do, and I just sat down and wrote it.
Right.
And it was kind of, I certainly never thought I could write a novel, and I'm also just beginning to really learn the depth of what it takes to do that. So I was lucky to be able to get this published, and a lot of people have really liked it. You know, it's definitely not a perfect work, but it's got something to say, I think.
So you also created a song for the novel, a song for Wayward Saints. How would you say the song captured the essence of the novel?
Well, I sat down to write the song because I was curious to see what kind of a song it would, the novel would inspire in me. And basically, it became very clear after I wrote the song, oh, this is what the book is really about. And I suppose the idea of, that there are a lot of people in the world who don't fit into the narrow category of success, and that's okay.
Yeah, yeah. So you've also written a children's book, Do You Want to Be in a Band? How did that come about?
Well, that was something that somebody actually approached the three of us, the Roaches, to write, would we want to write a children's book? And my sister Maggie wasn't interested, and then Terry and I went and met with the people, and we wrote a bunch of ideas, and they didn't like any of them. And oddly, I had written the first thing I wrote was this little story about being the youngest of three sisters. It's not really about the Roaches, but it's kind of just based on the idea of being a little sister, trying to learn how to do something that your older sisters can already do. And
sure.
So, when I wrote the story, I was kind of like, oh, this is kind of a little too sweet. But I sent it to the woman, and she liked it, and that was what she was looking for, something like that. So that's how that came about. And it's lovely. It's a lovely, very sweet little book. And it's a real kick to go around and do readings. And, I wrote a song to go with that one, too. And so you get together, and all the kids sit on the floor and you sing and read to them. And it's great.
Nice. Either with the novel or with the children's book, have either of those experiences wanted you to sort of write another novel or write another children's book?
I've written another novel.
Oh,
is,
wow.
Yeah, I have. I haven't, quite, I mean, I finished it, but I'm still going over several, drafts. I've revising it. So I have already done that.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I love doing it. And like I said, it's a very deep art form, and I'm, sort of learning how to do it. But I have actually done a whole other book, but I haven't sent it out to try to get published yet.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we go ahead and play another track from Fairy Tale and Myth? This one's called Double Rainbow. Before we play it, do you want to say anything about it?
This was a song that I was hired, or not hired, but asked to go to a museum and write about a painting at the museum. And I wrote this song about a painting that was at the Rubin Museum here in New York City.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a beautiful song, and it's funny because songwriters being inspired by paintings. There's a beautiful Paul Simon song, Renee and Georgette Magritte with Their Dog After the War. I think that's the title or something like that. And he was he was inspired to write that song after seeing some of Magritte's work or a particular painting. Anyway, from Fairy Tale and Myth, this is Double Rainbow.
Yeah.
of the painter fell upon me. There ain't nothing to fear. I wouldn't hurt you, dear. 'Cause we're in a fairy tale of circles and years of purple, giant orange moon, triangles and sad cartoons. I'm a lonesome fairy.
That was Double Rainbow, a Fairy Tale and Myth. Suzzy, thanks to our good friend Douglas Saunders, I found out the name of that town in Wisconsin. It was Kewaskum.
Oh, thank God for Douglas Saunders.
You know?
Yes, Kewaskum. I'll remember it well. And yes. Our friend John Kentworthy, too. I'm so grateful to him for introducing us.
Yes, yes. You know, we're getting close to the end of our time, but I want to ask you this final question. You know, throughout the years, you've done such varied and substantial creative work. What would you say are some of the things that have kept you so vibrant and alive and creative through the years?
I guess I'm kind of a shy person, and so I love to work because it's the way that I really get to know other people. And I don't know why I have such a voracious appetite for creating things and making things out of nothing, but I
yeah.
just have been like that ever since I was, you know, a young person. And I keep thinking it's going to stop, but it hasn't stopped yet.
Well, good
Who
for
knows?
You. Good for you. With me today has been singer, songwriter, and so much more, Suzzy Roach. Suzzy, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, and it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, what's the best way for people to find out about you online?
Oh, they could go to Facebook, I suppose, or my website, suzzyroach.com.
Mm-hmm.
And they could check out Lucy's new record at LucyWainwrightRoach.com.
Nice.
And her new record, The Last There's the Last Time for Everything.
Nice.
But yeah, we're all over the place on the internet.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I also want to send out a big thank you to our show's sponsor for all your writerly needs. Please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julie at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. Also, thanks to Tyson Cornell for production assistance with today's show. Poetescape's theme music is by We Voice Sing. You can find them online at wevoicesing.com. You can also find their debut CD of Wishbones and Gunfire on CD Baby, iTunes, Rhapsody, and Spotify. You can find me online at wevoicesing.com, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and you can find my poetry collection, Eighth in Agony, on Amazon or at Punk Hostage Press. Tune in next week when my guest will be poet Sarah Suzor. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poetescape.